Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a weekly series of coronavirus conversations presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share with you what we think are really valuable conversations here in The World's podcast feed. This last week, we took a look at the current response to the pandemic and the lessons that can be learned to avert future crises. Joining me was Dr. Howard Koh. He served as the 14th Assistant Secretary for Health for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and he's the Harvey V. Feinberg Professor of the Practice of Public Health Leadership at the Harvard Chan School and the Harvard Kennedy School.
So, Howard, you have real-world experience in how public health intersects with policy and politics. You basically landed right in HHS in the middle of H1N1, and you were as 14th Assistant Secretary for Health and Human Services under President Obama. You also are the former Massachusetts Health Commissioner. So with all of that, I wanted to start things off to ask, what is your assessment of our current public health system and how it's coping with the pandemic? Small question.
Well, thanks, Alana. And I think at a time like this, it's very important to step back and take the big picture. We're facing the worst pandemic this country has faced in a century. We have in the U.S. 1.5 million cases and close to 100,000 deaths. And even though we're only 4% of the world population, that's a third of the totals worldwide. And we've had so much suffering, economic hardship, shared sacrifice by the American people. In the face of all that, there's been tremendous heroic work at the local and state level. And I want to thank all the people in the country and especially in government who are trying to get us through this tremendous challenge. But we have not had the national coordination that we need. When a national emergency is declared, that means the federal government should be in the lead. And if we had more explicit federal coordination on guidance, standards, testing, contact tracing, coordination of PPE, and so many other dimensions, we could have a much more unified response going forward. All these themes are very important because we are fearful of a second wave this fall. That will come on top of seasonal flu. So we have to be even more prepared and have public health be even more unified going forward. And as I start here, Alana, let me just point out the pandemic, which is going so fast around the world, has come on top of a much slower pandemic that's engulfed the nation for too long, and that's the chronic disease pandemic. So we all understand that people with obesity and diabetes and hypertension and tobacco are at risk for disease and complications. We've had a society where we don't value prevention in public health enough. It's always overlooked and underfunded. And so as we move forward, we need to build more resilient systems to address all those issues.
How do you do that?
We need public health now more than ever before. And, you know, every fall now, Alana, I have the honor of speaking to the incoming Harvard Chan School of Public Health students. I thank them for choosing this career. I congratulate them for tackling this fantastic mission. But I tell them, you know, this is not easy because people really don't understand public health and it's usually invisible. Well, one of the outcomes of this pandemic is that is no longer true. Everybody understands the value of public health. It is very visible. We have a lot of work to do. And I'm just so grateful to see the response from our school and our university and around the country and around the world to try to tackle this and make our world healthier going forward.
But when you look at exactly how you strengthen that resiliency of a public health system, and it's come to light, the value or need of that right now, in what ways, what needs strengthening? This past week and weeks, we've seen hearings in Congress, in the Senate and House. We've heard from our top health scientists like Dr. Anthony Fauci, CDC Director Robert Redfield testifying. And, you know, what are the kinds of questions being asked? What do you think about those questions? But also then how do you build into what you're talking about in this more kind of theoretical way?
Yeah, so I have a couple decade perspective on this. So I was a sitting commissioner of public health in Massachusetts through 9/11 and anthrax in 2001. I'll never forget when 9/11 occurred, and that was a terrible experience for the country. But for public health, we saw anthrax a couple of weeks later, starting with a death in early October of that year, and then tremendous fear around the country for the next couple of months. So then as the state health commissioner, my job was to oversee the response. We had thousands of samples of white powders floating around our state. Our state laboratory was overwhelmed with requests to sample white powders, fearing that it might be anthrax. When it was all over, we had five deaths in the country, but public health was changed forever. We knew that we had to be better prepared for bioterrorism, for infectious disease threats, for natural disasters. And so the good news at the time was there was a lot of interest for training, for hospital preparedness programs, for boosting public health at the community level. And many of us were involved in those efforts. Actually, I first came to the Harvard Chan School of Public Health in 2003 and oversaw the Emergency Preparedness Center for 6 years before going to DC. And so many of us were involved in drills and exercises and plans, and funding was abundant. We had a lot of research efforts. But what we've seen over 20 years, Alana, is the cycle going up and down. Mm-hmm. At times like this, everybody's committed to better preparedness and response. But what I fear is that over time, that funding will go down yet again. We just can't let that happen. So as Congress is putting forward funds and stimulus packages, we need funding for hospitals, for community health, for contact tracers, for community health workers, for prevention, for public health. And we got to make that system so much stronger going forward.
How do you keep that steady, for example, when you have members of Congress turning over more quickly than that decade's term?
Well, one of the big messages I always put out as a public health professional is that we just can't take our good health for granted. I often point out that a perfectly normal, healthy day is a gift. It's a miracle. I mean, everybody wishes we could be back to where we were before COVID, but that's never going to happen. So if anything, a global challenge like this reminds us that our health is very fragile. We can't take it for granted. We got to protect it every day. That's what public health and prevention and preparedness is all about. And for the reasons I described, this is all interdependent and all interconnected. If you work on public health in any way, you are making the system stronger. And so that's why I'm very grateful to the school for hosting these webinars, to you, Alana, for putting out the message. We need public health to be stronger than ever before.
What is your takeaway, for example, at the World Health Assembly with Alex Azar talking about kind of its messaging of the U.S. within, for example, the world health community right now, the tensions that exist between countries and nations and navigating that politics for this response?
Well, when I was Assistant Secretary, I had the great privilege of joining Secretary Sebelius a number of times to the World Health Assembly. If you've never been, I want to say that's just one of the most inspiring professional experiences that anybody can have, to see people from around the world gathered in Geneva to talk about common goals and common mission. Right now, we have a common enemy, and that's the virus. And right now, this is the time to build global health organizations like WHO and build global partnerships in health. For the Trump administration to announce that they will defund their contributions to WHO, it is absolutely the wrong message. We need to be leading global health efforts, not undermining them.
So again, this is a Facebook Live, so we welcome questions from viewers right now, which you can post. So I want to get to some of those. So here's a question that comes from online that speaks to kind of the broader view. Since the 1980s, there's been a number of outbreaks per year that have grown a lot, and the number has gone up. Why is that happening, and how do you see that should be informing public health planning nationally and globally? I know you talked about there are these incidents, these things that happen. 9/11 happened. There was an anthrax scare, and it spurred so much response, but I'm wondering if you could respond to that.
Sure, that's a fascinating question. And the fascinating part of public health is you get to consider all these broad global issues. So if you step back, are there many reasons to explain the rising trends in emerging infectious diseases? First, the world population has more than doubled in the last 50 years. We have nearly 8 billion people on Earth right now. And then many of us are living in very densely populated cities. So that's one major reason why New York has been such an epicenter here in the United States. There's been, for a variety of reasons, more interaction between humans and animals, and the rise in so-called zoonotic infections has given us SARS and MERS and now coronavirus. And then we have a world that's growing smaller with airplane flights that can take you around the world in no time at all. So a person who is infected in one part of the world can easily infect populations in other parts of the world. It's been said that now that a pandemic anywhere is a pandemic everywhere. So for all these reasons, we're going to see these trends continue. This is why working together as a global community is more important now than ever.
So this is a question that gets to your first statement about kind of the need for a strong federal response, the way that you see it. There's this tension over whether states, governments, or the federal government should take the lead on something like this. And now we're seeing an easing of restrictions or a lifting of shutdowns, how depending on what community you live in around the US as an example, that will play out differently. And you mentioned that there are these guidelines that need to happen at the federal level. And so this question is, do you think these decisions should be happening on the federal, state, or local level, or through regional coalitions? And I guess I want to take that one step further, which is, given the reality that we're in right now, as places, for example, like Massachusetts are now trying to figure out how to navigate this, how do you bring the lessons from what you've learned to this present day situation? Like, what, where would you, do you advise taking it from here?
Thanks, Lana. That's a great question. And I can answer that with the perspective of being a former state health commissioner, then, but also a former federal official. And I think in times like this, in crises like this, we need best national coordination possible, a one government approach at the federal, state, and local level. All Americans want to know right now that there is some kind of system working on their behalf. And so the federal government can put out standards, they can put out guidance, they can coordinate efforts of states, they can compile data and put out consistent health messages. Now, every state is different and every state is unique, so governors and mayors can take that information and apply it to where they are, and that's the American way, and we respect that. Right now, we don't have that. So, for example, as we are reopening, every business, every school wants to know how to do that safely, and we need detailed guidance from the federal government. We've had some general directions put forward, and that's been valuable to the extent it's available, but we need much more detailed guidelines. And then as we reopen, we need to track this data very carefully. Cases, deaths, hospitalizations, ventilators, all these other themes that have been so critical in these last couple months. We have watched states competing against each other for equipment and supplies and PPE, and nobody wants to see that. So that's a role that only the federal government can play. And I really hope that as we move forward, particularly into the fall, we can make that coordination stronger, have a national plan that makes us work harder and smarter together.
Here's another question from online that speaks to that. When you think about a national plan, or when you think about the reality of what is happening right now, without a sort of vaccine right here and now that seems to be like the magic bullet sort of therapy, it seems like from a public health view, testing, contact tracing, these are really important parts of having a sort of managed approach to navigating society right now. So what is the intersection or role between states and local communities? How would that work effectively for something like contact tracing and testing?
Okay, great questions. I have so much concern about testing, which fortunately is improving, but still has a long way to go. We're doing about 350,000 tests a day in the United States, but that number has got to go up by orders of magnitude. But we need to not just think about numbers of tests, but also broader testing strategies. So we all know that the guidance so far has been to focus on testing symptomatic people. Mm-hmm. But with asymptomatic transmission being such a major theme through COVID, we have to focus more on high-risk sites like nursing homes, long-term care, prisons, communities of color that have absorbed a disproportionate burden of suffering and illness, and then focus there on asymptomatic people as well as symptomatic people. Now, these are testing and screening issues that always get complicated, so we need the best experts, advisors to be meeting emergently to help craft those guidelines going forward. So that's one aspect of a national strategy. For contact tracing, again, states are heroically doing work to get that up and running. This is a foundation of public health that everybody respects in infectious disease. Here in Massachusetts, there's been a great commitment that has been very inspiring. But this is an opportunity also to have the contact tracers be the foundation for community health workers, for tobacco cessation, for diabetes prevention, and have them part of the public health infrastructure that we've needed for far too long. And then for PPE coordination, we need more attention to domestic supply chain production so that, again, when the fall comes, we know what we have. We can distribute it fairly across the states. Every governor is clamoring for this on both sides of the aisle. And I think that's where the coordination is absolutely key.
This is a question from Shira. It has to do with community-based non-healthcare responses. How can the local level then be mobilized and supported? Have case studies and good practice emerged either from the current crisis that could guide the future?
Yeah, one of the big themes of emergency preparedness is that all preparedness and all response is local. And again, when I was Commissioner of Public Health, I spent a lot of time driving around the health departments in the state. Some of the health departments are two people, three people, and they're trying to do things like opioids and sanitation and tobacco cessation and all these other things. And then crises like this hit, and they're supposed to do that too. So again, I'm hoping local public health can be revitalized and funded. We've seen how local health officials have helped with testing and innovative ways to get people to receive testing services and not go to hospitals and medical centers and overwhelm an already overwhelmed system. We've seen local health volunteers send messages about how to distance safely and practice hand hygiene. As schools and summer camps are considered reopening, the local input is absolutely vital. So these are national themes and national challenges, but the answers are going to be at the state and particularly local level. And that's why public health is so amazing, because you meet all these people who, many of them without a health background actually, who want to make a difference and know that this is their time to do it.
So if you were to put on a local hat, this question comes from Georgia at the, Georgia at the WHO Collaborating Center for Maternal and Childhood Health in Italy. What might be the best strategies to put in place at a hospital, primary healthcare level, community level to better prevent a blast of mild symptomatic kids, feverish kids who might overwhelm the ER after schools reopen?
Okay, so I'm a physician who's trained in multiple fields and spent many years going to a hospital to go to work, and then as my career has gone on, I've had the privilege of seeing health from a broader population-based level. And it's always concerned me that people in direct care settings are working very hard but may not know what's happening in the communities right outside their walls. And conversely, people in community are very dedicated and concerned but may not know about anything that's happening with respect to healthcare sites in their communities. So if this can be a time for people in the community and in hospitals, professionals and non-professionals alike, to work together, to plan together regionally and statewide and say, if the fall is going to be as bad as many of us fear it's going to be, how are we going to collaborate and cooperate together? How do we know who has available beds? How do we know where we can get testing? When a vaccine arrives, by the way, that's going to be another set of challenges. And I lived through that through H1N1. Now, when I started, the vaccine was on the horizon. And then by the fall of 2001, it was available. And that fall, the department led two simultaneous flu vaccination campaigns, seasonal flu and H1N1. It was very difficult. It was not easy. And there are always issues with supply and demand when a new vaccine arrives, and safety too, by the way. So those are the things we got to get ready for. And the only way to do that is to be as proactive as possible and plan now.
Again, this is a Facebook Live conversation through the forum and at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Health and the World. I'm Alana Gordon, speaking with Dr. Howard Koh. We are taking your questions, so please continue plugging them in as you listen and find yourself curious and wanting to know things. So there's a few questions here that kind of, to me, lead one into the next, but I want to start and ask, when you think about over the years, you talked about the surge in, you know, efforts post 9/11, but what key programs have you seen reductions in funding or have been cut completely? And what do you think it would take to revive them? That's an online question.
Right. So one program that arose after 9/11 was the hospital preparedness program. And we have all seen that hospitals are already working in the absence of any pandemic at near capacity levels. And then in a time of crisis, they're asked to ramp up and exhibit surge capacity with respect to staff and supplies and space. So that's not easy. And hospitals have to plan and then make it happen. And many of them across the country have done that. It's been astonishing to see the heroic work of the frontline health professionals. So the hospital preparedness funding helped do that and also put all of us through trials and drills and simulations to see how readily and quickly we could implement some of those actions. We need to keep supporting those efforts and get people ready, and then also do that in collaboration with public health professionals in the community. The hospital preparedness program actually has suffered about a 50% decline in funding over the last 15 years, last time I checked. And that's another example of how the funding goes up and down, because as crises recede, people forget and they go back to what they were doing before, and then we don't think about it until the next crisis hits. We just can't let that happen anymore.
As you're observing what's happening right now, this question comes from online, and you see these kind of changes in programs. Has, for example, the CDC, has the credibility been destroyed over this pandemic?
Yeah, this is a difficult one for me because I've worked with colleagues at the CDC for my whole career. I mean, this is the premier public health agency in the world. There are thousands of outstanding public servants at the CDC with tremendous knowledge. And in times of crisis, the CDC is usually the agency that the American people turn to for advice and guidance and facts. Right now, they have not played that role. They've been sidelined. And we are very fortunate that we have tremendous servants like Dr. Tony Fauci. I had the pleasure of working closely with him, and we're all grateful for his sacrifice and his leadership. But we need the CDC and, in fact, all the HHS agencies to be taking the lead here in the best coordinated fashion possible. So that's what I'm hoping can happen in the future, because we've got a long way to go with this pandemic. We're running a public health marathon right now, and we're far from over.
Mm-hmm. So along those lines, when you think about, this question comes from Edward, that part of the important part of the response to crisis is effective leadership and communication. So in this moment, where should people be turning when one or both of these things are lacking?
Oh boy, what a great question that is. So I have come to learn through my career, through my experiences, through 9/11, through H1N1, that you need the scientific experts to be the communicators, and they need to determine what the latest evidence suggests, put out recommendations. You can update them and change them as you learn more. Look what we've done with the mask recommendations, for example. But it's best done when a health professional is delivering that message in a consistent way. My wonderful friend, Dr. Bob Blunden, does polling on this. And we know that in times of crisis, we need trust at the highest level. That trust comes when the science experts and the health experts are looking at the data, formulating the recommendations, and then putting them forward in a consistent, unified way. So that's what we need.
Hmm. I want to go to this next question, which is more down to some specifics, but it comes from Jacqueline. And she says, I wish everyday citizens understood the importance of public health. I'm sure you would agree. There are citizens who refuse to wear a mask because they feel there are sinister reasons behind this effort. What should we be doing to diminish the false statements?
Well, first of all, thank you, Jacqueline. this is an incredible field. It is fascinating, but it's also sometimes frustrating. Let's face it, none of this is easy. People are different. They react to crises in different ways. I believe in the power of science and effective communication. So if we can send out the message that here's the best science to protect your health, that our health is fragile, that we are in for the long haul here. Also, if you wear a mask, for example, you're protecting somebody else. And also, similarly, when a vaccination arrives, which I hope is going to be sooner rather than later, if you get vaccinated, you're not only protecting yourself, but protecting your family and protecting other people. That's what public health is all about. So messages like that, I think, help teach people what our incredible field is all about, and also makes a contribution to keeping people healthy.
This question is from Judith. Can you speak to the constitutionality then of ordering people to self-quarantine, wear protective gear in public?
Okay, I'm a doctor, not a lawyer, but we know that in crises like this, the states have the power to recommend and then enforce quarantine using the least restrictive measures possible. That's always the standard. I gotta say that in a time like this, it's been astonishing to see how many Americans very willingly complying with the stay-at-home advisories. And we now have this astonishing cell phone tracking technology to see how social mobility is progressing over time. And we've seen millions of Americans who understand the public health importance of staying at home and have followed those advisories or directions. Now we got to track that very closely as we move forward. Many of us are watching and tracking that IHME website that's overseen by our colleague Chris Murray. And I've noticed that recently there are figures and graphs and trends about social mobility by state. So that's a fascinating way to use technology to see if public health and prevention is moving forward. Let's see if we can demonstrate that we can work together as a nation to do reopening carefully and safely and with respect to the public health principles that everybody now understands.
This question comes from Sapna in India. Hygiene has played a vital role as we think about, especially now, movement. As we step into this new normal, what do you suggest as basics of hygiene to people? News you can use.
Yeah, so again, you know, hand hygiene, we take it for granted. Before COVID, we really didn't think about it too much. You know, during flu season, we'd put that message forward, and then we would perhaps pay not as much attention when the flu season passed. Everybody is talking about a new normal, about how we practice prevention, starting with simple hand hygiene, how we interact with people and don't shake hands, mask wearing. So prevention keeps changing. It's critically important. It saves lives. It's not easy, by the way. Everybody seems to think prevention is so easy, but it's not. And as one who has tried to research and advance prevention my whole career, I can say that for a fact. So if you're in India and committed to hand hygiene and see that as a way you can contribute to public health in your country and the world going forward, that's a huge contribution.
So hand hygiene, very important. One thing that might be a few steps from that has to do with something you talked about earlier when it comes to health inequities and how in some ways COVID-19, this is from a question online, is shaping up to be a case study in that, in health inequities. And I guess in my mind, maybe I'm quickly jumping to also the connections with chronic illnesses as well. And so when it comes to funding, what can Congress do to support public health programs to address these sorts of social determinants of health? And something I've just been hearing in the conversation is you mentioned some sort of connection with contact tracing, and I didn't quite connect that, but especially as all of these resources now are going into things like the pandemic, and there's a concern of a neglect for these other things. I'm wondering if you could reflect on that.
Thanks, Alana. That's a very critical question that I've thought a lot about professionally and personally. You know, I'm a son of immigrants, and so I feel this great commitment to health equity personally and professionally. We all know that health crises like this expose the fault lines of society. So the suffering that communities of color are experiencing right now is tragic, but not unexpected. And we are seeing example after example of minority groups having higher cases, deaths, and all related to a number of social conditions and then risk factor distribution. And again, related to the fact that we don't have enough attention to prevention and public health for an increasingly diverse society. So, you know, our country is getting more diverse by the day. That's what makes America strong. It's something that I'm very proud of as an Asian American and son of immigrants. And so our school, for example, has a very strong profile on addressing health disparities that I'm very, very proud of. And I hope that continues. And we have, by the way, you know, a more diverse society, according to many other dimensions, in addition to race and ethnicity, the sexual orientation, level of disability, rural versus urban. So as we move forward, attention to high risk populations that are really taking a lot of the burden here is going to be even more important than ever before.
And are there particular, going back to the question, just like funding programs, things to be focused on that have an eye on or that you would want to ensure can help address that?
I sure hope so. I mean, we've had several rounds of stimulus funding from Congress, mostly for hospitals and doctors, some money for community public health, but not enough. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, and that happened once H1N1 died down for me as assistant secretary, so I have watched the evolution of that fascinating part of history as well. There was a lot of attention initially as part of ACA efforts for community transformation grants and addressing disparities explicitly. Again, over time, that has faded away. And so, if anything, we need to now revisit those themes, make those efforts stronger, and make the public health system as resilient as possible going forward. The contact tracers, I think, is a start. But I don't want that to go away in 6 months and say, okay, that's over. We can transform that into a strong community health workforce that will protect America for a long, long time going forward.
This question comes from David. It's something that on a lot of people's minds, but as places begin to reopen, is there a way to ensure that small businesses are following reopening guidelines that exist in those communities, such as home hair salons? Or how can we help small businesses reopen safely?
Boy, what a great question. I mean, we're seeing how small businesses have been devastated through this. Again, I think if we can support them, obviously that PPP program from Congress is going to be very helpful to them, but we need much more than that. As public health professionals, if we can work with business leaders in society, that's going to be critically important. Actually, that's a area that I've been working on for a number of years with a grant from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, joining the Harvard Chan School of Public Health and the Harvard Business School. So if this is a time where business and health leaders in society at the local level and around the country can work together, start by focusing on small businesses because they have been absolutely devastated through this. And but and again, the theme of diversity comes in here. Many of those small businesses are run by people of racial, ethnic, minority backgrounds, and we need to support them to get back on their feet and also be healthier again.
So there's the like financial support that's necessary. Right. How do you, from a public health standpoint, just going back to the question, ensure that they're following guidelines or opening safely?
Okay, so we need more detailed guidelines and collaboration at the federal, state, and local level. We need to work more closely with local health departments on making all this move forward. Here in Massachusetts, you know, we just opened up yesterday. We're the second to last state in the country to do so. By the way, many of the people losing their jobs here are also losing their health insurance coverage. So this is where the Affordable Care Act is more important than ever before. We made so much progress at the ACA covering more than 20 million people. We just can't go back now. So attention to health insurance coverage, stronger primary care, safer workplaces, a stronger community health workforce, prepared hospitals for the next challenge, and making this all part of a national plan is going to be critically important.
I'm going to finally, just before we wrap up, there's a question that's been looming here from Barry. Focusing on specifically testing, what are some of the factors that you see that have prevented the U.S., which has, you know, led the world in biotechnology as an industry, from providing so much widespread testing that we see in many Asian countries, as an example?
Yeah, that's the issue that everybody is talking about. So I am watching South Korea very closely. Actually, the whole world is. And as a Korean American, that has actually special interest to me. And, you know, they have instituted very aggressive testing from the very beginning. Actually, South Korea and the United States had their first COVID case on the same day, January 20th, as I recall. And South Korea responded with very aggressive testing. One indicator to track closely is the positivity rate of testing, which in South Korea has always been around 2 or 3%. In the U.S., we started around 20%, which everybody agreed was way too high. It's now dropped under 10%. And, you know, this is not easy because this was a new virus. A vaccine had to be created quickly. It started in public labs, but then the private sector got involved. There's now more recently a lot of questions about the accuracy of both diagnostic tests and now antibody tests. So, you know, we're slowly getting there, but it's been much slower than places like Korea. Now, you could say that there are different cultural issues at play here. Also, South Korea went through MERS in 2015, and so the coronavirus threat was much more immediate to them. But again, this is another example of how we can learn from our global colleagues. We can all teach each other. Germany has done well, New Zealand. And so if we look at best practices at a time like this, particularly when a World Health Assembly is gathering, share them, show that we're a global community, we're going to be a lot better off when the next pandemic comes. And it will.
Or this one may last some time.
And this one may last some time, unfortunately.
At least that's what people like you or public health, people in public health have some different projections, and that's what could be one of them, is more of what I meant. But I want to thank you. We're just about out of time. And so we should be wrapping up. Before, just to kind of bring things back, I wanted to just ask this one kind of big question, which for you, why has COVID-19 in your you've been unprecedented in scope, and in particular in places like the U.S., so difficult to contain?
So pandemics are astonishing global challenges. And everybody who's been in public health knew that this time would come sometime. And unfortunately, it's now. Mm-hmm. To underscore some of the messages I've been putting forward here, you know, our good health is fragile and it's a gift. You just can't take it for granted. And if we in public health can say, okay, I can make a contribution in my own unique way to prevention and preparedness and public health in the country and around the world, because the next threat is going to come. We don't know what it is, but the more we build a better system and tell people the importance of public health, the better off we're going to be. So we are wrestling with a lot of the challenges right now. You've seen it in full display, but we have also learned a lot. We are now actually making progress as a nation in some parts of the country. We're watching other parts very carefully, and then we're watching the trends around the world. So we have to do this as a global community going forward, and then we have to go back to trying to regain some sense of normalcy in the summer and fall and beyond. I really want to thank all my colleagues who are watching this and who are doing their best to make public health stronger. I mean, it's the most fascinating and critically important profession in the world. And I think we're all learning. We've all been humbled by it, but we can all do more going forward.
That was Dr. Howard Koh, the Harvey V. Feinberg Professor of the Practice of Public Health Leadership at the Harvard Chan School and the Harvard Kennedy School. He was also the 14th Assistant Secretary for Health for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. This Q&A was jointly presented by The Forum at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World. And see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Join us again on Tuesday, May 26th at noon Eastern, when we'll be putting your questions to health communication professor Vish Viswanath about COVID-19 misinformation. Thanks for listening.